Civil Law Data Practices Committee to order. And you should have a copy of the minutes in your packet today. Do I have someone that would be willing to move the minutes?
No move.
Representative Winhagen moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor approving the minutes from January 13, 2015, say aye.
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 Opposed, the same? Minutes are adopted. This morning, folks, we have a full agenda. Let me see my copy of the order thing. Here we go. First of all, we have the Minnesota Department of Health, and they're going to come forward and give us an overview of the All Payer Claims Database. So if I could get those folks to come forward and introduce yourselves for the tape, please, and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Manny Munson-Regala. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health.
And my name is Diane Rydrick, and I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at the Department of Health.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Let's start with what is an all-payer claims database, or APCD. In general terms, an all-payer claims database is a large-scale database that systematically collects healthcare claims information from a variety of payer sources, which includes claims from most healthcare providers. I'll start with one quick statement. The word all is probably a bit of a overstatement. It is probably fair to say it is a most payers claims database. There are some payers that most APCDs do not collect data from. So the question is, why the heck do you have a database that contains all of this claims data? It all stems from the triple aim for health, which is how do we deliver health at lower cost, better quality, and that results in a better patient outcome? How do we answer questions like what's the best provider to go to from a cost-effectiveness and quality standpoint? What interventions work best? How do we save money in the long term? All very hard questions to answer without the benefit of data, which is why over 14 states have created all-payer claims databases. Those are the states in the dark blue. Then a number of states have begun the structure of setting up their own. And then about four more are thinking about or are beginning the process of exploring creation of an APCD. All in all, about 30 states throughout the country either have an APCD or in the process of creating one. With that as sort of background as to what an APC can do, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Rydrick to walk you through the Minnesota version of an all-payer claims database.
Can you move this a little bit so I can see much better? I'd like to be able to see what you all can see as I'm talking. So, Madam Chair and members, again, my name is Diane Rydrick, and I direct the Health Policy Division at MDH, and thank you for having us here this morning. As Manny noted, there are a number of states that have APCDs or are developing APCDs, and they're using them for a variety of purposes, largely linked to looking at how we spend money within the healthcare system. So some states use their APCDs to look at fraud and abuse, to look at patterns of billing or reimbursement that are unusual and that might indicate that fraud is happening. Sometimes they use them for comparing payment rates across public and commercial plans, so looking at how much a state's Medicaid program pays for certain procedures compared to commercial plans. Some states are using them to look at issues like the burden of chronic disease in different populations or regions of a state. In all, they're looking at areas for improvement, for cost, for quality, for delivery of care within their systems. And as Manny noted, a lot of these all-payer claims databases in other states are not really all-payer claims databases. They are most payers. Minnesota's probably comes closest to being an all-payer claims database because it includes claims from Medicaid, from Medicare, and from commercial plans. It doesn't include a couple of payers like VA and TRICARE and Indian Health, but we do have the overwhelming majority of commercial payers and public, as well as third-party administrators who handle claims for large self-insured employers. The data in the APCD for Minnesota goes back to 2009. And as Manny noted, this was part of a bipartisan health reform effort that passed in 2008 in Minnesota. So we're going to talk just a little bit about what data is in the database and what is not. The data that we collect in the APCD includes medical slash health services claims information for insured Minnesotans, so people who have insurance coverage and who live in Minnesota, with a few exceptions, as I noted, things like VA, TRICARE, Indian Health Services, workers' comp, et cetera. Some of those smaller payers are not included. And certain small payers by volume are not included. So certain payers that have less than $3 million a year in total claims or less than $300,000 a year in pharmaceutical claims are not included. The data includes information about the prices that are paid for services as well as the services that are delivered to individuals. In terms of identifying information about individuals, includes only age, not date of birth, gender, and zip code. What it does not include is patient name, address, or social security number. It doesn't include people without insurance, and it doesn't include people who live outside of Minnesota but may receive care here. I'm going to talk just a moment about how we secure the data that we're responsible for collecting. And for this, I'm going to refer to my notes because there are a number of things I want to make sure I mention here and don't forget. There are a number of steps that we take at MDH to secure the data, and it includes physical, technical, and administrative controls on the data. First, as I mentioned, there are no personal identifiers that are in the data. Any data that's submitted to MDH comes via secure FTP, so a secure file transfer protocol. It's encrypted, as we like to say, in motion and in rest. So it's encrypted as at the point when it is sent, and it is encrypted while it is retained within our servers. Personal identifiers, such as name or address, are encrypted by the data submitters prior to coming to us. It's what's called hashing, or a one-way encryption. It means that the health plan, Blue Cross or Health Partners or Medica, transforms a name or an address into a code that is unrecognizable to us, and we don't have the key to unlock it. So only the health plan that submitted the data has the ability to unhash it. We never hold the key, and we never have that information in unhashed form. That means that no data user within the health department can reverse engineer the data. Our data aggregator monitors the IT infrastructure regularly to ensure security, and they also conduct an annual security audit. That means that they do what's called penetration tests. So they attempt to hack into the servers and see if there are any weak spots. They do that annually, and they report to us annually on those results. And they also do more of a proactive audit to make sure that best practices are in place for privacy and security. So they look at what's required by HIPAA, and they look at what's required by an organization called NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to make sure that best practices are in place. In terms of access tracking, within the health department, we only allow members of the research team and members of the IT team that are maintaining the data on our secure servers to access it. We monitor access to the server, so we can monitor logins, and we can monitor failed logins, and we get reports on that regularly from our IT department. So we know that only those who have authority to access the data and who have a need to access the data are able to do so. Within MDH and within our data aggregator, data are stored on secure servers. They are not linked to the internet, and the data are not accessible via the internet. Finally, authorized researchers within the health department don't have the ability to copy, download, transmit, or otherwise move APCD data off of the secure servers. So that means no data on laptops and no data leaving the servers. Briefly, I want to talk about authorized uses for the APCD. I think one of the reasons why...
Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Should we save questions till after the presentation, or...?
Why don't we do that? I think they're kind of getting close to wrapping up, so we'll, if that's okay.
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, we have just a couple more minutes, and we'll go quickly. In terms of authorized uses, there are just a handful of uses that are authorized for the APCD currently, and several of them were established just during the last session in 2014. Generally, the only authorized uses for the APCD right now are for aggregate, statewide, regional, or county-level analysis. So MDH does not have authority to do any analysis that identifies a provider organization, so nothing that would result in publication of a comparison of clinics or hospitals on any of these measures. What we're authorized to do is to study variations in cost, quality, utilization, and disease burden by geography or by population. So that would be, for example, looking at chronic disease at a county level or at a regional level. We're authorized to work in collaboration with a stakeholder effort called the RARE campaign to look at readmissions to hospitals. We're authorized to do an evaluation in collaboration with the University of Minnesota of the Healthcare Homes Program and of our State Innovation Model Grant to do a study of chronic pain, which was actually just released last week, and to explore whether the APCD may be suitable in the future for risk adjustment. Briefly, current studies, which I just alluded to, the chronic pain study was something that the legislature directed us to do last year. They asked MDH to use the APCD to look at procedures for chronic pain. So, for example, when people have steroid injections or other procedures for chronic back pain, they wanted to know what types of procedures are happening in Minnesota, how often are they happening, what sorts of conditions do people have who get those procedures, where are they happening, not specific facilities, but are they happening in hospitals or in clinics or in doctor's offices, and are they being done by physicians, by osteopaths, or by certified registered nurse anesthetists. So that study was just released on the 15th and is available on our website. We can certainly provide you with copies if you're interested. A second study that we're working on right now is something called potentially preventable events. We know that there is a lot of potential waste within our healthcare spending that's associated with procedures that may not add that may not have been necessary for a patient. So a certain percentage of admissions to the hospital or readmissions to the hospital or ED visits, emergency department visits, may be preventable with a different type of care, a different type of access. So this study is kind of a starting point to look at how often those potentially preventable events happen in Minnesota, knowing that any one of them may not actually be preventable, and that's something that a clinician really needs to look at. But it's kind of a starting point for a discussion on where there may be savings within the system. A third study that we're working on, again, in collaboration with a number of partners within the healthcare delivery system is called low-value healthcare. It's linked to the Choosing Wisely campaign, which, if you've heard of it, it's looking at things like providing best practice guidelines to providers on things like when should you use antibiotics for infections or for certain certain illnesses, when should you do an early delivery or a C-section, what are the best practices in the clinical guidelines that can help ensure that providers are using procedures that are appropriate for a patient and that are guided by evidence, and trying to limit the use of those that are lower value. Finally, we're looking at something we're calling the Minnesota Atlas, which is similar to the Dartmouth Atlas, looking at the burden of chronic disease and the cost of chronic disease by geographic areas in the state. So how many people have one or more chronic diseases in different counties, and what are the costs associated with their utilization of the healthcare system. Finally, just very briefly again, in 2014, the legislature authorized, or directed rather, MDH to establish a very broad work group to look at the APCD and how it could potentially be used in the future. So we were directed to pull together a very broad work group that includes providers, payers, consumers, academics, and a couple of state representatives to advise should there be additional authorized uses for the APCD in the future? If so, what might that look like? What might be some of the guidelines for potential use in the future? What sort of governance process should there be overseeing use of the data? How should we ensure privacy and security? How should we finance such a system? So it's just a set of recommendations that this group will be making to the legislature, and that report is due on February 1st. And that concludes our formal presentation. We included just a couple of links to more information about the APCD, knowing that this was a very, very high-level summary of what it is, and you might be looking for a little bit more information.
All right, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, go ahead with your question, please.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two or three questions.
You bet.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hopefully they'll be very quick. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate the overview. You know, there's a lot of concern about government dealing with data on individuals. I happen to be a case where I believe MNsure released my Social Security number to an outside vendor, and I got information on that, and that was probably a year or so ago. So my questions have, some of the questions have to do with that. You know, when I look at this, it does contain the zip code, right, under on page 3?
Ms. Rydrick.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes, that's correct. We do have a zip code.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The question is, do people opt into this, or how do they opt out, or is this just done automatically in terms of the data collection on their health information?
Ms. Rydrick?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, when the legislature established the APCD, they directed MDH to collect the data from payers and told us which payers to collect it from. They did not establish an opt-in or an opt-out at the time that it was created.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm assuming that it's automatically done at this point. Is that correct?
Ms. Rydrick.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that's correct.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The protecting data, we hear assurances from government and officials, and I'm not trying to impugn your integrity in any way today, but, you know, we hear assurances that data is protected, and yet we hear breaches of personal data on a regular basis with government officials. My question is, what is the consequence if somebody within government breaches this data and shares it with unauthorized individuals? Is there a strong enough consequence to deter that? Because based on the number here in Minnesota and across the nation, I rarely hear what the consequence is to the government of individuals who breach personal data for individuals.
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen. So I'll start with the Data Practices Act and its application to our collection of the data. So as you know, the Data Practices Act governs both the publication of public data, but also prohibits the release of non-public data. As I recall, the violation of the Data Practices Act results in civil penalties to the individuals who produce non-public data. In addition to that, to the extent that some of the data might contain HIPAA, the penalties that would apply to HIPAA violations would also apply to disclosure of non-public data. I would make the point, though, that the data that we have is at the level of aggregation that it would be remarkably hard for someone to be able to figure out that this particular individual with this age, this gender, this zip was me. So that would be sort of my general observation.
And Ms. Rydrick.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I would just add as well, we have policies within the department as well related to how we manage data, and we're required to take training annually about what our requirements are under the Government Data Practices Act as well as under MDH policy. So if somebody violates our internal policies related to how they're managing data, particularly if someone is intentionally doing anything that they should not with data, there's disciplinary processes that we go through internally as well that are guided by our employment relationships.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you for those responses. So the individuals in the past who have breached personal data here at the state, do you know if they've been prosecuted, disciplined, or what steps have been taken? Because, again, based on news reports or information I've received, I don't see anything that's been done other than the allegation that they breached it, but no follow-up as to what the consequence of discipline was. And I think we've got to send a strong message to people who do this type of thing, regardless what department, that, hey, this is unacceptable. To me, they should immediately lose their job once convicted. And maybe some other consequences based on the individual whose information was compromised or breached. Would you respond to that, please?
Either one of you want to take a stab at that?
Sure.
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm not aware what might have occurred at other departments. I think at our department, we're not aware of any breaches of this type. I've read in the media accounts of people losing jobs and being subject to criminal investigation at other departments, but that question's probably best directed to those departments.
Representative Grunhagen.
This is my final question. Okay, appreciate those responses. If you've got any information, maybe I need to talk to somebody else to find out. I'd appreciate it. The on page 5, you talk about current studies, and I understand the value of those things in terms of reducing costs. But one of the things with the Obamacare or with MnSure that people are concerned about is the potential to micromanage the doctor-patient relationship. In other words,
unelected, nameless, faceless government bureaucrats decide what, if, and when, based on your height, weight, and your age, whether you receive treatment or not, and overriding the judgment of a professional doctor on that treatment based on cost savings rather than medical necessity. Do you believe these types of studies could eventually lead to that? Or what safeguards do we have in place to prevent unelected, nameless, faceless bureaucrats from micromanaging the doctor-patient relationship?
Ms. Friedrich.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think a good example to answer your question is the work that we're doing on low-value healthcare, or the Choosing Wisely campaign. One of the ways that we avoid going down exactly that path that you're describing, which I agree is a concern that I've heard of as well, is to work really closely with providers as we do this analysis and as we try to figure out what it really means when we see certain results. So with the Choosing Wisely campaign, we're working very closely with organizations that are supporting that campaign in Minnesota, and that includes MMA, it includes specialty societies that have done their own analysis and are providing guidance to their physicians about services that they consider to be low value. So you've probably seen some coverage in the news about different specialty societies saying this is a test that you should maybe question if it's offered to you because it doesn't always offer value. If we can partner closely with organizations like those and with provider groups and with stakeholders as we're doing this analysis and as we're talking about the results, I think that helps us to avoid going down that path. It's certainly not our goal to tell people what are the right services to provide. That has to be the clinician's decision. That has to be the healthcare provider's decision. But what studies like that do is give us at least a starting point as a state for a discussion about where might we be able to save money, knowing that in the end it's that doctor-patient relationship that is going to determine what services are right for that patient.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just a follow-up general observation. The concern about this comes from the Independent Payment Advisory Board at the federal level, mm-hmm. who the articles I've read in national papers seems to be more concerned about cost than medical treatment. And in fact, Rahm Emanuel's brother, Ezekiel Emanuel, I believe I had that correct, and I used to have the editorial of the Wall Street Journal, he's a bioethicist, and he wrote an editorial about one of the biggest problems with our medical profession is the Hippocratic Oath. And we all know the Hippocratic Oath is first do no harm. It doesn't talk about cost and keeping costs down as much as not harming the patient. And he saw that as one of the biggest impediments to the implementation of Obamacare in terms of reducing cost. And you put all those things together, plus these current studies, and, you know, it's circumstantial evidence, but the potential for micromanaging the doctor-patient relationship, and I've talked to some of the doctors who believe they get put into a box already in terms of what they can and can't do, and, of course, we know some doctors are pulling out of the system. So to the degree that you can safeguard the citizens, and especially my treatment, if you want to take names, of my family and my children and grandchildren, I'd sincerely appreciate it, much less your own. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Metzen-Ragala.
Madam Chair, Professor Grunhagen, I think that's precisely part of the purpose of a database like this, which is to empower patients to make the choices that they want to make. As we have more responsibility for our care, both financially and from a patient-driven perspective, one of the key disadvantages that our current structure has is the lack of information patients have in making those decisions. An all-payer claims database can level the playing field and allow patients to have a conversation with their provider about what is best for them. The more data we can provide them about what's working, what's not working, what might be a waste of time, that's important information for patients to have. I also, by the way, Madam Chair, I will share one other resource that the committee might be wanting to use. It is a report that House Legislative Research prepared on the Data Practices Act from 2010. And in that, it mentions that the violation of the Data Practices Act is a misdemeanor. So in addition to the civil penalties, there is some criminal sanction.
One last follow-up there, Representative Grunhagen, before we move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. Hey, I appreciate that response. The you know, just a specific example of that I've already observed, and again, I've sold health insurance for over 35 years, individual and group. I have a business owner, and by the way, I had him videoed. Okay, so if you like a copy of the video, I will give it to you. And his premiums just jumped for his small business, you know, 50, 60, 70%, depending on which option he chose. None of them were good. But his wife has multiple sclerosis, okay? She takes a drug that costs $2,800 a month to help her manage that disease. According to the business owner and his insurance agent, January 1, that drug's no longer covered. They cannot afford to pay $2,800 a month, okay? So I realize the assurances you've given me. The problem is when you have an emphasis on cost savings versus the best treatment, I believe the system's going to begin to be skewed towards lowering cost versus the actual treatment that patients need with especially critical illnesses. That's just an observation from my standpoint.
And Representative Gruenhagen, I think, too, that part of this is not just the conversation here today, but it's with the Department of Human Services and the policies that we set here that may affect people's health future.
Thank you.
So, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I did like about the presentation is the security procedures you have in your system. By not having it online, it makes it a lot harder to obtain that data. But one of the questions I have is deals with the information that you do obtain. Now, by getting that zip code, last year we had a discussion about the zip code and whether or not the plus four should be added or not. In rural Minnesota, I don't know if you have the plus four on the zip code or not.
Who wants to take a stab at that one? Ms. Friedrich.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I will have to ask our database managers on that. I do not know whether we have the plus four.
Okay, we'd like that information for sure. Representative Johnson.
The reason I ask that is with the plus four in greater Minnesota, you can actually end up at somebody's driveway. And even with just the zip code, yeah. I have towns in my area. There are communities with a post office with a population of less than 100. Now you have an age and you have a gender, you know who that person is. Mm-hmm. So I have a little concern to that with in the greater Minnesota. We have a lot of towns like that, right, and a lot of small post offices where just the age, gender, and zip code, you know who that person is. So it's got to make sure that data is secure.
Thank you. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Representative Johnson touched on a little bit on what I was going to say, but I just want to reiterate what the Department has said about the aggregate nature of the data that's not individual-specific, and you know, Representative Johnson points out in some instances there could be concern in remote areas of the state, but I think it's important to understand twofold that this is limited data that the department doesn't have identifying nature of the information to identify it back to an individual. And then furthermore, the tests or the research that there's been some concern of, that research is being done because we requested it to be done. I mean, we have the results of the pain procedure research following legislation and a debate over the scope of advanced practice nurses and what the role in treating chronic pain is, because we had a group of advanced practice nurses saying, yes, advanced practice nurses treat chronic pain with interventional procedures in Minnesota, and we had a group of physicians that said, no, that never happens. There might be one rogue nurse anesthetist doing it, but otherwise, that never happens. And so this legislature said, well, we can find out. We should use the aggregate data to do a large picture study of healthcare being provided in the state of Minnesota. And so, while I share concerns and other members on the committee may share concerns about government intervention or federal health care or the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Understand that this is a small photo from a 10,000-foot view that describes what the aggregate vision of health care looks like in the state. We should accept that. If we don't want them to do studies, let's not ask them to do studies. If we want them to do studies, let's ask them to do studies. But when they do them, when we ask for them, we probably should just read the studies.
And I appreciate those comments. However, one of the things that I remember a couple of years ago, we were talking about this issue of people opting in to be basically research subjects. And we had a professor from the University of Minnesota at that time who was a professional. She had a legal degree and a some sort of a medical degree. And she said the primary rule number one in doing research is that the data subjects know that they're data subjects. And that is one of the reasons that I wanted to have you folks in today. I do have concerns with that. And I'm always a big proponent of people having the option to opt in or out. It should not be an automatic. And whether it's just simply signing a HIPAA form that people think that their privacy is being protected when it's actually not, that's a form saying that you can share my data with other folks. I feel like there should be some sort of a Tennyson warning, something of that nature, so that people know that their health records are being looked at and used for studies. Another concern I would have is I believe you mentioned that you were looking at potentially expanding the scope of the data that's collected or the scope of how it's studied. And I wondered in the legislation that you cited, and I don't know that I wrote that down, when the legislature said, okay, we want you to gather all this data, did they give you specific data sets that you were allowed to capture? Ms. Reidrich.
Madam Chair, so you had a couple of questions there, but were you asking about when the APCD was originally authorized?
Yeah. Yes.
So when the APCD was originally authorized, and it's in 62U.04, we were directed to collect claims data from payers and from third-party administrators, and it includes information about the types of data to be collected, which includes information that's generally on a claim. I mean, this is claims data. So the types of information about treatments and diagnoses, et cetera, that are on a claim that is submitted by a provider to a payer are the types of information that come into the APCD. So it was sort of outlined in that general way to describe the types of information that are generally covered in claims transactions, and that's what would come into the APCD. You also referenced the study, I think, that's coming out in February. So that was a study that the 2014 legislature asked us to do. They didn't ask us to necessarily look at whether there should be additional data that's collected, but rather to say, is there value in this data? Where do we think it could be used effectively as a public resource to kind of inform some of these conversations? And if so, what would that look like? So the report doesn't have any recommendations for new data to collect, more what might it look like if the legislature decided that there were other uses it wanted to authorize, and what kind of oversight should there be for that process.
And just more of a statement than anything else here, if you want to expand the uses of that data, folks, that's what we're here to do, is say yes or no to that. The Department of Health or whoever else is wanting this information has to go through us first. They just can't automatically collect or expand the use. So I appreciate your testimony. Any other questions from members? Representative Lunin. Is that no?
No. Bogle,
sorry.
Bob.
my apologies.
Madam Chair, I'm curious. It says most providers. Excuse me. I'm wondering who most providers is relative to the collection.
Ms. Reidrich. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually it's most payers. So the providers don't provide us any data. It's the folks that handle claims payments. So, for example, if someone was paying for their services in cash, we wouldn't get that data. This is from the third-party payers, like insurance companies or state public agencies. Basically, public and private insurers provide us claims data. You don't have a claim if you're a cash patient. And
one follow-up.
You bet. Representative Vogel.
So then, as far as the integrity of the data, if it's not collecting all of the data, do you feel comfortable that you're getting a good sample so that the report that's going to be generated is truly reflective of what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Rydrick.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, yes. As we noted just in passing in the presentation, there are a few smaller payers that are not included just by law. If they don't have enough business, they're not included. We do know that the coverage of the database right now is upwards of 85% of all covered individuals in the state. So we do a lot of checks just to make sure that the data makes sense based on what we know about enrollment, based on what we know about Minnesota's population. We do a lot of logic checks and quality checks just to make sure that it is robust, because it would not be in our interest to be doing this research if it was not sufficiently representative of the population. I did also want to if I could answer a question that was asked earlier. Mr. Munson-Regala is a whiz at looking things up while we talk, and he did confirm we only have the 5-digit zip code and not the +4.
Thank you for that information. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony, and we're going to turn things around here a little bit, switch the order of our agenda today, and I'm going to ask Representative Hillstrom to come forward, and we're going to hear House File 200. And since putting this bill on the agenda, we've had some feedback from some folks that have some issues with the bill. So today we're going to hear the bill and lay it over for consideration. And so with that, I will invite Representative Hillstrom to the testifiers table. Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The Andersons came to me with a very compelling story, and that's how I ended up being the author of House File 200. So I'm going to let them tell their story, and then I have people from the Uniform Laws Commission here to tell you about the bill, because usually when folks come to you and they say they have an issue that needs to be solved, they look to you and say, I don't know how to solve it. But here, they came and said, we have an issue to solve, and we know what we need, and there happens to be a uniform law about it. So with me is Mrs. Anderson. I'll let her tell you her story.
Mrs. Great. Anderson, go ahead and please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Christy Anderson.
My name is Bill Anderson.
And we thank you for having us here today to share our story. As I said, my husband and I are here to urge you to adopt the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Law to allow family members of vulnerable adults, as well as family members of victims like ourselves, whose son, our son Jake, was killed and his phone was never opened. Imagine the bygone era of sitting in grandma's attic and being able to page through a box of mementos, photo albums, old postcards and letters, and those sorts of treasures or gifts. Now let's fast forward to the technological era that we're in today, where our cell phones and our social media have become our lifelines. These house those photo albums, ledgers, online banks, filing cabinets, calendars, and all of your music library. The real question is, whose data is that anyway? So with that in mind, I want you to imagine another instance in which you hear a knock on the door on a cold December afternoon, and when you go to the door and open it, you see two police officers and a chaplain standing there looking at you, asking you to come in, telling you the unimaginable has happened. Your beloved, talented, handsome, wonderful, athletic, smart, intelligent, friend to all and leader among his peers, the same boy that wrote a letter to his future self about his hopes and his dreams, your 19-year-old U of M freshman son was found dead that morning, frozen by the river's edge. Shock. You're told that he was to walk a girl home from an ugly Christmas sweater party the night before, and that when he stepped outside so this girl could go in and pick up her jacket, and she came back out, he was gone. Nobody knows what happened to Jake. He disappeared in those moments. Was he abducted? Did he get lost? We don't know, but we think his cell phone could possibly contain some of those answers. And soon after that, you learn that his case has been closed and it's been ruled an accidental hypothermia case. And you have no recourse for opening up his phone and looking to see what his last days, his last hours, his last moments before that tragic death were, whether he has sent some texts, whether he tried to call for help, whether there are cell tower pings that might have told you the route that he took to this last location. Or, being opened, it might show you nothing at all. There may be nothing, but that too is an answer for a family. And once again, you're told you can't have this data because he's 19, and because the case is closed and it was ruled accidental, and you need a subpoena, and since the case is closed, you can't get that, and Apple and Sprint won't give you the information without the subpoena. So it's a rather interesting circle. And oh, did we tell you that we bought this phone? We own it. It's in our name. It's on our contract. And nowhere, anywhere on that contract does it say Jake Anderson. We contend that someone's digital assets are no different than those treasures that you find in the attic, your real estate, your possessions, or even your diary. And who should own that data? Certainly not the tech companies. We believe the beneficiary or a fiduciary should have access but not control of the data as long as it's not been prohibited in a will already. And that is why we offered up a petition of almost 5,000 people on Facebook called Access Jake. We used it to sort of educate people with the importance of digital planning, because as we realized, few parents would ever think that they couldn't have access to their student, college student's digital data. And we learned that too late. It's unbelievable to most folks. But this issue is going to continue to impact each and every one of us, because the outdated laws were created before Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google. In fact, cell phones and computers are not only passcode protected, but they're also now fingerprint protected, a really cool feature my son's computer had too. We need to plan ahead, but we also need to provide for protection for vulnerable adults, the elderly, and potential victims of crimes in their families, or your own families, should something happen to you and you die or become incapacitated. To us, losing Jake so unexpectedly, unexplained, and tragically makes anything and everything that he ever touched priceless, including that phone, and what could be in there. Were this the era of the shoebox full of letters, this conversation would be moot. So we beg you to put this legislation into action. Do the right thing and sign this for Minnesotans. If you have any questions about our message, our emotion behind it, you have a flyer in front of you that tells you a little bit about Jake and some of our situation. And we thank you for the support. We thank you for the folks that showed up in red to support us as well. So we will stand for questions.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your testimony, Ms. Anderson. My condolences for your loss. And I know that all members, not members of the committee, have lost a child, especially in the circumstances that you have, and I can only imagine the grief that you've gone through. And you were able to turn it into something positive by bringing this bill. And I'll confess to you that I am genuinely on the fence about your proposal. Ever since Representative Hillstrom brought it to me, I started thinking about all the benefits, and one of the all the benefits were the ones that you testified to so ably. And I also thought about the potential negatives. And I don't know all of those yet, because I think there's some people that are going to testify in opposition, so I'll wait to hear what they have to say. But I, at the beginning of your testimony, you talked about the box up in the attic that Grandma had all her stuff in, and I remembered my Aunt Stella. My Aunt Stella was born in 1891, and when she died, she had one of those boxes. And I remember my mom going through it and finding all this stuff about her life. And I remember my mom mentioning, well, there's nothing about Stephen in here. And I thought, who was Stephen? Well, Stephen was a son that she had out of wedlock when she was very young. And she loved Stephen more than anything. But she was incredibly embarrassed because during those, at that time in life, it was not something that you talked about. Having a child out of wedlock, it was highly embarrassing. And she didn't put that in the box. And that was her choice to do that. With a phone, I wonder, we don't have the choice of what to put on there or not. It includes everything about our lives. And the other side of what I'm thinking about is I wonder, what if I was in that situation of your son, and what would I not want my parents to see, no matter what? So I just don't know the answer to that, and that's why I'm struggling with it. But I'm sure I'll come to a resolution soon, and you testified very ably, and thank you for bringing this up today.
Members, I also have someone briefly from the Uniform Laws Commission who actually have brought this issue nationally and have been successful in having it adopted in many states, and there will be additional legislation in other states this year as well, and they happen to be from Minnesota. So,
okay, if they want to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Jim Lamb, L-A-M-M.
My name is Gene Hennig, H-E-N-N-I-G.
Go ahead and proceed with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, I'll just speak briefly. As I said, my name is Gene Hennig. I'm one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners. We have 10 of them, and it's our job, as I think most members of your committee and the legislature are aware. What we do is to write uniform laws on subjects that we feel are worthy of uniform law treatment. In this particular instance, we're talking about access to digital assets by a fiduciary. We believe that such an act would be highly beneficial not only to the citizens of this state, but nationally. And for that reason, we prepared, our Uniform Law Commission prepared a uniform law to address this very subject. We are here today to suggest, to recommend and endorse enactment of this uniform law here in the state of Minnesota. As you will hear later, this act has already been promulgated. It's been introduced now by almost half the states in the country, and we're very much looking forward to seeing it enacted throughout the United States so that problems such as you heard from the Andersons can be addressed in an appropriate fashion. I won't say more about the Uniform Law Commission since I'm sure many of you are aware of its work. I'd like to turn the discussion over now to my colleague, Jim Lamb, who's a national authority on this subject. Together with Jim, we produced the initial drafts of the Uniform Law, and so Jim, I think, is eminently qualified to guide you through certainly some of the privacy issues that were just alluded to by the representative and any other issues that may be of concern to this committee. Thank you very much.
Mr. Lamb, go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Jim Lamb, and just to clarify again, the purpose of this bill is to vest fiduciaries with the authority to access and control or copy digital assets while also respecting the privacy and intent of the account holders. Fiduciaries play a very important role in our economy. They act on behalf of healthy living people, incapacitated people, and deceased people as well. And these fiduciaries, and what I mean by fiduciary would be the court-appointed personal representative of a deceased person's estate, the court-appointed conservator for a living but incompetent person, an agent acting under a person's power of attorney document, or the trustee of a trust. This bill confirms that a person's fiduciary stands in the shoes of the person, even in the digital world. And just to make four quick points about this bill, it gives account holders a choice. It gives you the choice of whether your digital assets, whether it's stored on your computer, your smartphone, or in the cloud, are preserved or distributed to your heirs or destroyed. It also treats digital assets just like your other property, your real property, your tangible personal property, or your intangible personal property. And it also protects service providers like Microsoft and Yahoo and Facebook and Google and Apple, and copyright owners as well. under UCATA, this Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, the fiduciary has to prove that they're authorized to act on behalf of the accountant. And these service providers that comply with the fiduciary's authorized request for access are immune from liability under this state law. A fiduciary's authority is limited by their fiduciary duties, the information necessary to carry out their job. And the final point is that this law is uniform to give service providers nationally and family members locally some certainty, no matter where their data is stored, whether it's Minnesota, California, or Washington State, or Florida. I'd be happy to answer any questions about this bill.
Members, any questions? I just wondered if you could kind of walk us through the difference between when a minor child is deceased versus a 19-year-old, and what the legal differences are there as far as access to their personal items.
Right. Madam Chair, the fiduciary, when a person dies, would be the personal representative of the deceased person's estate. And so the court appoints someone to act on their behalf, gather their assets, pay debts and taxes, and distribute things. So when it's a minor, they haven't had the opportunity to draft the will yet. But they are able to set preferences in an account if the service provider allows that. So some service providers have all of their terms of service, the relationship between the provider and the account holder, set in a document, a contract. Others let you set options. For example, Google has an option called the inactive account manager. When you pass away, you are no longer able to log into your account becomes inactive. You can specify that you would like one or more individuals to receive a copy of the contents of your emails and photos you store on Google's servers. So even a minor would be able to set those preferences, or you can specify in Google's inactive account manager that you do not want anyone else to access that data. So normally a person would specify that in a will, and then the court-appointed fiduciary would respect those wishes and intent of the account holder in the will. But it is possible, if the service provider provides the option, to expressly grant or expressly deny access to some or all of your data stored in the cloud.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Some of the accounts simply say, though, upon your death, the account ceases to exist, and no one is entitled to that information. So imagine if your bank chose to treat that your assets in the same way and said, oh, no, you died, therefore no one could get access to your assets. We all would be outraged because it's money. And in this case, your service provider may just simply say, no, upon your death, we're done, and you can't get access to any of that information ever.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just thanks for the testimony. Like in the previous case here with the Andersons, and again, you have my sympathies and condolences also, does anybody have access? Are the police able to go through that cell phone under current law? Or, you know, isn't it, to me, somebody died, their phone's there. Who has access to that information as far as investigation of the death is concerned?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if there was a criminal investigation, law enforcement would be able to get search warrants for the phone. However, if it is not a criminal situation, or it's not being investigated as a crime, then you don't have probable cause to get that search warrant to get into it. And so in this case, it was ruled accidental death by hypothermia, therefore no search warrants were issued.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just a follow-up question, Madam Chair. Okay, where's the phone then? I mean,
they have it right
there. Oh, they have it, but they can't access it? It's been erased?
No. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So many of us put little PIN codes on our phones so that we can only open them. Can't get at it if it's locked. They don't have a right to get the number from anyone.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. So if I turn 18 and I'm nervous about my parents seeing what I'm doing and the unfortunate incident of my death, is the only way for me to stop it under this legislation, would it be to have a will? Or what would I have to do in order to protect my privacy in that eventuality?
Mr. Lamb.
Yes, Representative. A will is one option if you die. Another option would be in the particular account that you have to specify those wishes. So, for example, your Google Gmail account or your Picasa photo sharing account or your YouTube channel, you could specify in their terms of service and the privacy preferences whether fiduciary access is allowed, third-party access, or to delete your data when you die. You could specify it in a power of attorney while you're alive. You could also just write a letter that specifies your wishes if it's authenticated.
So,
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lamb, the Andersons are wondering specifically about Sprint and Apple, so I'm assuming Sprint and Apple didn't have those options. Is that true?
Mr. Lamb.
That is correct under their current privacy settings. They do not have those options.
Okay. All right. So in this case, the only situation their son would have had would be to have a will. Is that without the legislation, is that right?
Mr. Lamb.
A will or some or written letter. Direction to not have access or to affirmatively have access, generally that's correct, to access the contents of his emails that are protected under the federal.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The challenge with not having a state law about this, though, and just going based on federal law, is even if you have the letter granting you access, the service provider may provide it to you, not must provide it to you. So you don't legally have the right, even if you've been granted that access in a will.
So, Representative Lesch?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure if I'm understanding this right. So, in reality, if Sprint and Apple wanted to, they could still do it right now. Is that... But that's not
Mr. Lamb shaking his head.
That's not correct. The federal privacy law protects the contents of certain electronic communications. For example, if there was an email account at Apple through this phone and there were emails stored in the cloud by Apple, generally the federal privacy law says Apple cannot disclose that without meeting one of the exceptions in the federal privacy law, 18 U.S.C. 2702B. And one of those exceptions would be with the lawful consent of the young man who passed away. What's unusual about the federal law is it does say emails that are sent to you, that are received by you, your agent has access to access those. So if they get a court-appointed personal representative for his estate, they could ask Apple to turn over the emails that Apple holds in its storage that were sent to him, not the ones sent from him, although the legislative history of the law says either sent or received emails and other electronic communications, the contents should be accessible by agents. The confusion right now in the federal law that we're also trying to get changed is it does not explicitly authorize in the text of the legislation emails that you send for agents, but it does in the legislative history.
Representative Lesch.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, it just sort of, I would think that there would be an easier way to go about this. And I understand that due to the circumstances of Jake's death, that the police department stated that there was no reasonable suspicion or probable cause, but I just can't imagine there wouldn't have been a way to have a limited investigation with a very prescriptive warrant for just the 5 minutes or even an hour period of time. But I didn't make that charging decision, so it's not up to me. But hopefully we can find a way to solve this. So thank you for your answers on that.
Any other comments from the testifiers at the table? Just walk us through then, Representative Hillstrom, the remedies in this bill, and how they would be practically experienced, because to me, you know, there's not a lot of young people that I know that are conscientious enough to make a will, to have something that's they hand to their parents saying you have access to my data should something happen to me. So, and I know Ms. Anderson is back there raising her hand. Looks like she'd like to respond as well. So I don't know if you want to take the...
I was just going to add from the standpoint of a parent of a student going off to college, when you're going through your orientations in your high school, getting ready, prepping for college, nowhere does it ever come up that you would possibly need
a digital data release form. We created a health, we went ahead and did a health care directive for both of our kids when they went to college because we had been told that was a smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. But because this is so new and people aren't aware that this digital data is at risk, and here we've fallen into between those cracks, is if had we known back then, and that's a whole education process for the colleges, for the high schools, for everyone involved, that's one of these potential, you know, gaps that we need to make sure we close.
Thank you. Mr. Lamb.
Just to add on to that, I'm a third-generation Minnesota estate planning attorney, and we regularly do work with our clients to get a financial power of attorney and a health care directive for kids going off to college once they turn 18. We put this digital authorization language in our power of attorney documents. We also, I've published a one-page standalone that anybody can sign and do that same authorization. It doesn't require a lawyer, but it's good to always consult.
Well, as a parent of two folks that are children that are in college right now, you've certainly made me aware of this issue, and that's one thing that I'm going to be asking my children to send me right away from college. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we just redid the short form power of attorney. I had never heard of this issue, and it's not on the form. Mm-hmm. So this is a new and evolving issue. I think they've been working on it for about 3 years. I hadn't heard about it until I met the Andersons.
Right.
And so it is an issue that we as a state are going to have to decide. How are we going to let people have access? Are we going to let them have access? And who are we going to let have access?
Right.
So that's the reason I have the bill here, Madam Chair. And there is a technical amendment that we had drafted that came through the Uniform Laws Commission to get the bill closer to what they would like it. I don't know what you'd like me to do with that.
Why don't we go ahead and move that since it's only technical, and that will be on the bill then when we lay it over.
Thank you, Madam.
Go ahead and move that amendment, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your packet there is an amendment labeled. I'm looking for my copy. I apologize. The A1 amendment, and I just would like that to get the bill in the shape that I would like it, Madam Chair.
Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Gearing. Oh, we vote first. Oh, okay. We need to have someone move the bill first.
So, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 200 be before the committee.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor of having the House File 200 before the committee for possible layover, please signify by saying yes.
Yes.
Those opposed, same sign. The bill is before us. Then we can move the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that that I would like it. And members, this is just an amendment brought by the Uniform Laws Commission to get the standard, the bill in the shape they would like it.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same. The amendment is adopted. I believe there's someone in the audience that wishes to testify against the bill, in opposition to the bill. So is there anyone here that's in that category?
I think so.
Well, I guess they aren't here. I don't know. Did they send their testimony? Do we have that? Someone,
Madam Representative, I believe that there was one email that I saw that was actually looking for a substitution of language. And members, I just want members to be very aware that all of the people who you heard from participated in the process of putting the Uniform Laws Commission Act together. They took public testimony. They talked to service providers. They talked to everyone. And kind of at the end, then this indemnity kind of came up. And so I just want you all to know that the Uniform Laws Commission process is a very open process, and everyone had a seat at the table during that debate.
Representative Zerwas.
It kind of struck me as we were talking about this, Madam Chair, in that Mrs. Anderson started the conversation talking about the cardboard box in the attic. And I think this is more like the equivalent of when my grandfather passed away, the giant safe in the basement. And so we kind of figured out, what the heck do we do with this? And does anyone know how to open it? And eventually, we got a really big drill. And we drilled into the safe, and I thought, oh my goodness, what's going to be in there? with a couple old photos, his army uniform. Very cool stuff, but no giant revelation. But my point, Madam Chair, is that 30 years ago, 50 years ago, people locked stuff up. Mm-hmm. And when they passed away, the family got together and said, let's break in and let's get it. Mm-hmm. And I think now the reality is we lock stuff up digitally. Now my photos are on the cloud. I don't even know what that means. And if and when I pass away, I hope my family can go get it. And I think that's what we're saying for the Andersons.
I'm a co-author on this bill, but yet I come from a different perspective. All of us, most of us, I would say, around this table have loving families, parents that were loving parents, and we would want them to have that information. But what this bill I'm not clear on is for those that really don't want their parents to know, or the parents that haven't been good to those children. And so how do we protect that victim's privacy? I don't know if anybody there at the testifiers table wants to address that. Mr. Lamb.
Be happy to address that. This bill doesn't change the federal privacy law. So, you know, whether you have protected health information, protected under the federal HIPAA law, information protected under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, information protected under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This bill doesn't change that. You still need to meet those exceptions under the federal laws or state laws to get at private information. What this does is it clarifies that existing law extends to the digital world. And so to take email, because that's the most common one talked about as a digital asset, we still need to meet one of the exceptions under the federal privacy law. Then one of our four fiduciaries covered in this act can get at the contents. Now, the other sections of this act let us get some of the identifying information. And I give the example of a U.S. mail letter. You can see when you hold a letter, the sender, the recipient, probably a date stamp from when it was mailed. That's what someone can get by default under this act. You can tell what emails were sent, to whom they were sent, and when they were received, the date. But you can't see the subject line or the content of the email without meeting one of the federal privacy exceptions, which this is not changing.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, and I kind of want to expand on your point just a little bit. Would they have access to deleted, so if I delete pictures or an email in my account because I'm afraid that when I pass, got that cold going here. It's I'm going to get you. But, no, so if they delete it, are they recoverable? Because I know that we can do forensic investigations on a phone, but yeah, if things are deleted, but would this give that access? Because how I look at your statement is if I'm really concerned about what my family's going to find once I pass, or I don't like them or I don't want them in there, I'm going to arrange that so that people would know I don't want my brother or I don't want my sister or aunt, whoever is. This is who is going to be in charge of it because I really hate that person, so they're not going to be entitled to it, or I'd throw it away or shred it or otherwise. So whether you like them or not, once you've moved on to wherever, whatever faith you believe in or don't, and meet your maker, by that time, I don't care what they find in my drawers, to be honest with you.
Mr. Lamb.
Representative, that's an excellent question, and you partially answered it, I think. You gave the example of paper files. You could throw them in your wastebasket, you could shred them in the shredder and ensure pretty much nobody can get at them. The same is true for files stored on your personal computer. If you put them in the trash can and empty your trash, it's kind of similar to putting it in your paper trash can. It's still there. But if you shred it on your computer, it would be gone and generally unrecoverable under current means. In the cloud, it's a little harder to answer that question, the sheer scale of the storage. Generally, when they delete a file, it gets overridden very rapidly because that storage is constantly being reused. But in theory, at least on your personal smartphones, computers, tablets, storage devices, if you haven't shredded it, it may be partially recoverable forensically unless you've gone the extra step of shredding it, just like your paper files.
Representative Schoen.
Oh, shoot.
Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in many instances now, many of these technologies, you can't access them forensically. The Andersons have actually already tried going to every hacker they can find that they could pay to get in. But in many instances now, technology is set up so that if you don't want someone in there, they aren't getting in. So,
Representative Sean.
Yes, Madam Chair. And the new Apple, I think, software with the 5 and upgrade to that has made it impossible. But the last question I had, and somebody can tell me offline, is who was the investigating agency in the Anderson case? Was it the Sheriff's Department or the city? That's what I wanted to know.
City of Minneapolis.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple questions about the operation of the bill, and especially, I guess, for deceased individuals. So it looks from my review that a deceased individual can specify their desire to not have somebody look at their assets in one of two ways. One is via will, and then the other one is through having an express provision in the terms of service agreement that they affirmatively agree to. Am I reading that right? Or are there other ways as well?
Mr. Lamb.
Yes, that's correct. I suppose you could also have some other written document saying that's not necessarily your primary will, saying include or exclude this, and that could be before a probate judge, and that would be part of the person's intent.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so that would be something then that would have to be ordered by the court. I guess that would be the third means as well.
Mr. Lamb.
Yes, and that's a really important point to make here as the committee moves this forward. The current HF 200 in front of us says that we can use the current Minnesota streamlined procedure for an informal probate, so there doesn't have to be a court hearing. It's an efficient process. The vast, vast majority of probates are handled informally like that. You could also take the proceeding formal and present outside evidence of intent to the judge and have the court order non-access or deletion of the file. The reason I bring that up is my understanding that someone objecting to this bill has proposed maybe some alternate wording. That alternate wording would always require a formal probate. You could not do this informally because it would require an affirmative probate court judge's order after a hearing to grant access to any digital assets. And that would be a dramatic change in how we have streamlined our court process and keeping costs down. So this bill piggybacks on what existing Minnesota probate procedures allow.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Pinto, do you have another question?
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. So I guess, because I'm thinking about a situation where many individuals will not have wills, as was talked about, just, you know, that's just the fact, and probably wouldn't be ordered by the court, so they're going to be relying on interaction with their service provider. And what I'm seeing here is just that, because you talked earlier about, you know, you could arrange it with Google or whoever it is, that it does require a separate provision under the terms of service agreement that has to be affirmatively agreed to separately from the other provisions. So the point is, somebody does have to go out of their way somewhat in order to keep information out of the hands of their personal representative. Is that
Mr.
correct?
Excellent point. Let me just walk through real briefly. There are three categories of digital assets. So the most protected are the contents of your electronic communications protected by federal privacy law. So by default, the fiduciary does not have access to that unless an exception is met to the federal privacy law elsewhere. The other two categories would be the catalog of your electronic communications. And so that was the outside of the envelope example, the addressee, the recipient's name, the date it was sent, non-contact information, that by default is granted to the fiduciaries. So they can, for example, go into somebody's email account, they can only see that you sent and received emails from U.S. Bank, Wells Fargo, another financial institution. So now, as a fiduciary, you can go to their brick-and-mortar location and ask for the records through the normal process. But you still have no access to the content. The third category under the Act is any other digital asset, you know, not protected by the Federal Stored Communications Act, not this catalog, but it would be the files you have on your smartphone and your computer and your tablet. So those, again, are going to be default access to the catalog and to the data files on your computer, but the protected content of your electronic communications requires some extra act, some extra exception being met in the federal privacy.
Thank you. Members, we are going to be going over a little bit. We still have one more subject matter to take up, but Representative Lesch has a quick question.
Well, I just thought, Madam Chair, when the testifier brought up not having to go through probate, and I understand the object of the bill is not have to do that so you can streamline everything and keep it out of the courts. I get that. However, is there any provision to the extent that something would have to go through probate that a judge could review this evidence in camera with very prescriptive. Thank you, Madam Chair, that word, measures to satisfy family or next of kin? Is that done currently, or could that
Mr.
be done?
Mr. Lamb.
Excellent point. Just to clarify my previous statement, it's still probate. It's called informal probate in front of a registrar rather than a full court hearing. Typically in Minnesota, that's done by mail. There's a procedure, and if it meets certain criteria, probate happens informally, they call it, without a formal hearing and process. Any interested party can ask that it can be converted to a formal probate where a judge can have a hearing noticed to all the interested persons and an opportunity for everybody to be heard. If there are any concerns about the decedent's wishes or about any particular privacy concerns of the family.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony, everyone, and for bringing this bill forward. And we're just going to be laying this bill over. We don't need to take a vote on that, as I understand it. I thank the Andersons so much for coming in today and sharing a very painful story with us. And I know that I can speak for the entire committee that our condolences go out for you, and I hope that we can bring some resolution to this for you folks. With that, I'll dismiss the testifiers at the table and ask Mr. Gimberling to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Gimberling, go ahead and state your name for the tape, and go ahead and proceed.
Will do, Madam Chairman. I got a handout. I think there's enough for the members of the committee. So.
Okay, great. The page will help you distribute those.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Don Gimberling. I'm a member of a organization called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, mostly because I don't have to report to a boss anymore. I'm also the organization's spokesperson. The idea was I can't ever get in trouble with my boss. So the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, which we acronymize as MNCOGI, is a 501c3 organization. It's an all-volunteer organization. It's composed of an interesting mix of journalists, both active and retired, academics, attorneys, citizen activists, and in my case, a retired public employee. Our objective, essentially, is to try and maximize government accountability by assuring that most government information is available to the public, okay? And so as part of that mission, we do show up here from time to time and testify on legislation. We also have a fairly long history of dealing with these kinds of issues. I've been listening to the testimony you've heard from the beginning and going, welcome to my world. So anyway, a couple of things that we do in this particular case on January 28th, we have an annual session we host within the Capitol complex. This year it's the building up in the press room, I think, in which we bring together people who want to talk about information-related legislation. We talk about the things we're interested in and give other people the opportunity to talk about whatever they may be bringing forward by way of legislation. So it's kind of a look at forthcoming information-related legislation in the session. We invite you to come to that session if you'd like. We've already invited the chair to come and speak and talk about some of her concerns. We're very nonpartisan. with a capital N, which it sometimes leads to very lively discussions on the board of Minkoji. We also have an annual award we give called the John R. Finnegan Award. Those of you who have been around for a while know that John Finnegan was the editor of the Pioneer Press and for years was one of the strongest advocates for access to government information and government accountability. And so we annually award that, give that award to person or persons, and we'll be doing that again. We do that on March 16th, which is, most of you probably don't know, is Freedom of Information Day. It's Freedom of Information Day because James Madison, our president, was a very strong advocate of public access to government information, and March 16th is his birthday. So that's kind of who we are and what we do. And as I said, part of what we look at is legislative issues, and what your handout is a list of things that we're focused on in this particular legislative session. And I'll just quick highlight the things we're concerned about. Some of you know that the license plate reader discussion started last session, actually it started before the session, and is continuing again this session. License plate readers are devices that essentially can be placed either on moving squad cars or on stationary locations that collect all of the license plate numbers that the device scans on an ongoing basis. And there's some serious issues of privacy, surveillance, et cetera, associated with that. And it currently, at least the House and the Senate, have differing approaches, particularly on how long that information should be kept. Our position has been essentially that because of the mass surveillance aspects of license plate readers, that unless the reader produces what people colloquially call a hit, i.e. something that leads to a criminal investigation, that the data collected by license plate readers ought to be destroyed almost immediately, okay, after some decision is made about whether or not there was a hit. There's been an ongoing discussion about data that's provided to the state of Minnesota by health maintenance organizations that relate to various issues of how much those organizations are collecting or charging for their services, their contracts with providers, and what those charges are, etc. It has a controversial aspect. There was a couple of bills last year which resulted in something the legislature does from time to time, which is a study to be done by the Department of Human Services. That study was supposed to be provided to you, I think, January 15th, and it's you've already been told by the department it's going to be late. So our position there is that most anything that involves how public money is spent, the public ought to be able to find out how it's being spent, what it's being spent for, et cetera, in most cases. Another relatively new issue that has a data implication is body cameras. Body cameras are the kind of new wave of a different kind of government accountability. However, in how our Data Practices Act works, the data that's collected by the camera is subject to the Data Practices Act. So then you go into issues of how those data ought to be classified, who has access to them, et cetera, et cetera. And you're going to have, I suspect, a real lively discussion about body camera data. The government and other people are increasingly using drones. I just got done reading the latest Dan Brown novel, you know, the guy who writes novels about art, etc. And prominent in that novel was a drone following the major character around for a portion of the novel. Our position on drones is essentially, again, it's important to know that, the number one, if the government is using these things, and if so, what's being done with the data, and are there any controls, et cetera. I know some of you have had this discussion about drones, but when you think about drones, don't think about those things that we're using in foreign countries to surveil and in some cases kill people. Modern drones can be the size of a butterfly. Okay, and those butterfly drones not only can be fly through your window, they also can be equipped with high-definition cameras and very good recording devices. So technology is going to put a lot on the plate of this particular committee. We participated in the discussions of the Legislative Commission on Data Practices that you created last year. We think that commission did some really good work, and we hope that there will be continued support for the commission and the legislature on an ongoing basis, because as I think you heard already today, these issues get pretty complex, okay? And it really helps if you have people within the legislature who can devote the time to understanding the complexity and, even more importantly, unravel some of the complexity. Let me give you an example. There was concerns expressed about, in the last discussion, about access to sensitive data on telephone. Okay. Well, there's already precedent in Minnesota law for access to very sensitive data by survivors of somebody who is deceased. Okay. That was the discussion the legislature had about 15 years ago. And the very sensitive data, frankly, is I think what most of us consider to be the most sensitive data that exists about us, and that's medical information. And Minnesota law currently gives survivors access to medical information. Now, it's a little bit more detailed than that, but if I were to die tomorrow and my daughter wanted to go in and look at all of my medical records, she has a right to do that. Okay? And that's existing law. So one of the things we do try and help you with is, if you've already kind of set what to us looks like a precedent, and you may not notice that because of complexity and the density of modern law, we help you by reminding you that that kind of thing is there. Now, some of the things that we're thinking about and what you have on this sheet are things that the board of MnCoGI has basically taken a position on. Some of the issues that are floating out there that we may come up with legislation to present to you are, there's a classification of data within the Data Practices Act called security information. It was originally intended to cover things like access to passwords, access to where keys of things are located. I remember the example that was always used when the bill was being heard was access to the actual architectural plans of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, because those plans had to be on file in the city of Minneapolis for zoning and building inspection purposes. However, we're seeing a trend in that security information is being used from time to time to trump parts of the Data Practices Act where you have explicitly said certain data are public, and yet a government agency takes the position that even though you've said it's clearly public, that those data are security information, which is a much more general category, and therefore cannot be made available to the public. So we may bring forward some legislation. One of the areas that you don't spend a lot of time on, and frankly the state of Minnesota does not spend any appreciable money on, is the whole idea of when do you get rid of government information and records. There is an existing statute called the Minnesota Records Management Statute that was enacted in 1973 or 74. At the time, it was a pretty forward-looking statute in how it dealt with the disposition of government records. However, it assumed that the state was going to make some investments in how that process worked. And by investments, I mean actually have people working on the issues. And it's been rare since its passage that the state actually did invest in that. So why do we care? Well, we care because the ultimate question of government accountability is the ability to look at records. Even in the past, you've already had discussion this morning about when certain parts of legislation were enacted. You know, I was sitting here this morning thinking about the All Payer Claims database, and I thought, geez, am I the only one in the world who remembers the Health Data Institute? Anybody else remember the Health Data Institute? Ah, you see, the Health Data Institute, into which you put a lot of money, collected tons of information, including the kind of stuff that's in this database, and frankly, I never saw anything done with it, okay? And then once upon a time, the Health Data Institute disappeared. So you, at some point, we may come to you and say, you need to do some stuff with the records management. What's a growing issue is the government's use of social media to do its business, and whether or not that fits in the Data Practices Act. Yesterday on the news, I saw a press release issued on Facebook. Okay, And increasingly, people are told when they go to government agencies to ask for access to certain public information, they're told to sign up for Facebook. Look at us on Facebook. And I'm not sure that's what you intended with the Data Practices Act, but it may very well be. But that's the kind of thing at some point you may end up looking at. Lastly, part of what we do is we do take calls from citizens. You know, our website tells you how to get a hold of us and that kind of thing. And one of the things we're seeing these days, and again, it doesn't surprise me given the evolution of digital stuff, is under the Data Practices Act, if you want to make a copy of government data, the statute says the government agency has to provide you with a copy, and they can charge the reasonable cost of making the copy. Well, surprise, surprise, these days, more and more people walk into a government agency, and they don't walk in with a phone like this, okay? I'm real old, low-tech. They walk in with a phone that photographs stuff. And increasingly, people are told, on the one hand, by some government agencies, oh, great, copy all you want. That way we don't have to do this and take the time to do it. But they're told by other government agencies, no, you can't use your phone to copy stuff. Well, maybe you can, but we're going to charge you a fee for that. And the answer to that in the Data Practices Act is currently there isn't an answer. When I used to work for the state and get those questions from government agencies, my basic answer, and I probably wasn't this blunt, was basically, why do you care? Mm-hmm. Okay? If some citizen is going to come in and save you work, which I hope saves you money, then why do you care if they copy stuff themselves? Okay? But there's a very possession-oriented reality of government information when you come and talk about people who work for the government. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. You'll see us again from time to time. I offer you the best of luck in your work. Based on some of the questions I heard today, you're a pretty savvy group. So, especially
thank you,
some of the questions from Representative Grunhang and others. So, good question.
Thank you, Mr. Gimberling. Thank you for your testimony. And would you want to give a plug to your meeting that's coming up?
Yes. January 28th, 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Up in, I think it's room, I don't know the number.
It's the media room.
It's the media. 181 or something.
181 or 182, something like
yeah.
that. Very
so,
good.
It's a pretty open kind of discussion. We'll start probably with guests. I'll give an overview similar to what I just gave, although it'll be shorter. And then anybody else who wants to say anything, we've invited other legislators. We're not sure whether or not they're confirmed yet. Anybody else who wants to jump in and say, you know, we need a bill on X or I've drafted a bill on Y, it's a pretty open kind of session.
Thank you, Mr. Gimberling, for being here. For those of you that are new, Mr. Gimberling was in on the writing of the Data Practices Act. So if you have questions about any area of your bills that may pertain to that act, he would be an excellent resource. Representative Grunhagen.
Madam Chair, are you going to send out an email on that meeting? Or?
We certainly can send out an email on that. I'd encourage you all to come if you're available. Okay. With that, folks, we are adjourned.